Hi there, and welcome back to the Cory Doctorow podcast. I am trying to keep up the momentum and do a weekly. So here I am 1 week later. And just to remind you of what's coming up, I'll be at San Diego Comic-Con in mid-July. On the 31st of July, I've just signed up to co-host Hank Green's book tour for an absolutely remarkable thing, his debut novel. And I'm flying to Houston for that. So if you're in Houston, you want to see me and Hank Green, July the 31st is your day. Then if you're a burner and you're going to be a Burning Man, you can catch me on the 28th, that's Wednesday, at Liminal Labs at our camp. That's at 8:30 and Center Camp. And I'll be interviewing Andrew Bunny Wang, the Xbox hacker. On the 29th, on Friday, I'll be speaking at Palenque Norte at 1 p.m. And then TBC, I'm also going to speak at Center Camp this year. So I'll keep you abreast of those talks as they come up. On September the 11th, I'll be in Santa Cruz to help Randall Monroe on his book tour for What If, his new book. And then on September the 12th, I'll be in San Francisco for the Pioneer Awards. On September the 13th, I'm back to Houston to set sail with the Writing Excuses Cruise, where I'm going to be an instructor this year, along with Mary Robinette Cole, who has just won the Locus Award and the Nebula and stands a good chance of winning Hugo. And then I'm flying to Toronto for Word on the Street, where I'll be headlining on the 21st of September. On the 22nd of September, I'll be at the Toronto Public Library's Oakwood branch with Jim Monroe. And then on the 23rd of September, I'm keynoting the Six Degrees Conference. So that's all the stuff that's coming up this summer, and I hope I can catch you at one of those things. I've started writing a new short story called Affordances. It's for Future Tense, which is a joint project of Slate and Arizona State University, and I'm writing a short story called Affordances for their AI series, and you can catch the progress of that on my daily words hashtag on Twitter and Tumblr. And I'd ask if you are excited at the prospect that you support the Clarion Write-A-Thon. I'm one of the participants this year. Clarion, of course, is their writing workshop at UC San Diego. I'm both a graduate of it and an instructor at it, and I am also a volunteer on the board of the Clarion Foundation, which supports it. And the money that we raise goes to support our program activities, especially scholarships for diverse students and students who lack the means to take 6 weeks out of their lives and come to San Diego to learn how to write science fiction. And it's become a pipeline for getting more diverse voices into the field. What else do I need to tell you? Well, I should keep you abreast of what's going on with other writing projects. As I mentioned before, the Third Little Brother book is now in my editor's hands, and they've made an offer, and we've accepted it. Still don't have a title. It might be called Crypto Wars. It might be called Hopeful Monsters. We'll see. It's not on the schedule yet. It's a book for adults. At the other end of things, I've got a picture book for little children called Posey the Monster Slayer that another Macmillan imprint, First Second, is going to publish. And I've just signed off on the final proofs of that. That'll be a 2020 title. And as I mentioned last time, I've just turned in the manuscript for a short book or a long pamphlet about surveillance capitalism and monopolies and why monopolies are the things we need to worry about under surveillance capitalism, called Working as Intended. And I'll let you know as progress progresses with that. And then it occurs to me that I haven't mentioned on this podcast yet that I have a new book out, four novellas called Radicalized. The novellas are Unauthorized Bread, which is being adapted for television by Topic Studios, and Radicalized, the title story, Model Minority, and then finally The Mask of the Red Death. And that book is out now, and you can get it wherever finer books are sold, including at my own site at craphound.com/shop. And then the last bit of personal news before I get down to today's podcast is that we got kittens yesterday. We have a couple of theoretically hypoallergenic Russian blues called Peeve and Warlock. They're a brother and sister. I have not seen them yet because they arrived very late last night and have been hiding behind my daughter's bed all day. But I go into her room every half hour and see if they're out yet. They're not out yet, but I'll keep you up to date and post some pictures as the time comes. It's fun to have pets again. So what I'm going to read to you today is a thing called Fake News is an Oracle. It's my column from the latest issue of Locus magazine. And you can read that online at locusmag.com. Fake News is an Oracle. Several times over the 13 years that I've been writing this column, I've railed against the toxic myth that science fiction is a predictive literature, a way to know the future. Science fiction writers are not fortune tellers, and that's obvious because no one is a real fortune teller, because the future is unknowable, and because the future changes based on what we do. With that said, there are two different ways in which science fiction has a relationship to our future. First, it can serve as a warning or an inspiration, influencing the actions that people take, and thus the future that they choose. Second, and far more interestingly, science fiction can act as a kind of Ouija board for our societal ideomotor response. When you and your friends put your hands on the Ouija's planchette and invite the spirits into the room, the movement of the planchette is driven by tiny subconscious nerve impulses that cause you and your friends to move it around the board, picking out messages. These messages aren't from the great beyond, but they are from a mysterious realm, the usually invisible and inchoate world of you and your friends' unspoken desires and fears. In the same way, science fiction responds to our societal ideomotor responses. First, the authors write the stories about the futures they fear and relish. These futures are not drawn from a wide open field. Rather, they make use of the writer and audience's existing vocabulary of futuristic ideas, robots, internets, and AIs, spaceships and surveillance devices. Writers can only get away with so much exposition in their fiction, though I've been known to push the limits. And so the imaginative leaps of a work of fiction are constrained by the base knowledge the writer feels safe in assuming that their readers share. So the writers write the stories. Then the editors choose some of those stories to publish, or the writers publish some of them themselves. Then readers choose some of those stories to elevate to the discourse, making them popular, and integrating them into our vocabulary about possible futures, good and bad. The process of elevation is complicated and has a lot of randomness in it. Lucky breaks, skilled agents, PR wins, prominent reviewers' favor. But the single incontrovertible fact about an SF work's popularity is that it has captured the public imagination. The warning in the tale is a warning that resonates with our current anxieties. The tale's inspiration thrums with our own aspirations for the future. Reading a writer's fiction tells you a lot about the writer's fears and aspirations. Looking at the awards ballots and the bestseller lists tells you even more about our societal fears and aspirations for the future. The system of writers and readers and editors and critics and booksellers and reviewers act as a kind of oracle, a societal planchette that our hands rest lightly upon, whose movements reveal secrets we didn't even know we were keeping. Which brings me to fake news. Fake news is a nearly useless term encompassing hoaxes, conspiracy theories, unfalsifiable statements, true facts spoken by people who are seeking to deceive audiences about the identity of the speaker, and as a catch-all, meaning, I read a thing on the internet that I disagree with. But for all that, Facebook is useful in one regard. The spread of a given hoax, or unfalsifiable statement, or truth delivered under color of falsehood, or conspiracy, or objectionable idea, undeniably tells you that the idea has caught the public imagination. The fake news that doesn't catch on may have simply been mishandled, but the fake news that does catch on has some plausibility that tells you an awful lot about the world we live in and how our fellow humans perceive that world. Take the anti-vax movement. It proceeds from two observations about the world. First, that the pharma industry, like so many other industries, has become concentrated to the point where executives no longer fear meaningful competition. Second, its execs are part of a cozy club that is small enough that its key members can fit around a single boardroom table and undertake conspiracy with one another. Second, anti-vaxxers believe that the regulators, who are supposed to be keeping industry honest, are instead willfully blind to the misdeeds of the giants that make up the industry. The regulators are largely drawn from the executive ranks of the industry, and/or they expect to find work in those industries when they leave government service. The regulatory process, nominally a truth-seeking exercise driven by evidence, has become an auction, with regulatory outcomes available to the highest bidder. What's more, the auction has so few serious bidders, thanks to industry concentration, that they're able to collude to get stellar bargains out of the people's alleged watchdogs. So the anti-vaxxers say pharma is corrupt and will literally murder you to earn an extra dollar. Regulators let them get away with literal murder, and that's why we find the idea that vaccines are unsafe to be so eminently plausible. What's more, evaluating the safety of vaccines is an esoteric, highly technical matter, one that combines the statistical literacy to evaluate studies with the media literacy to understand the difference between reputable journals and disreputable ones. And that's before you get into the microbiology, chemistry, and epidemiology. The truth is that none of us are qualified to understand the evidentiary basis for almost everything we believe. And so we evaluate the process by which the evidence is weighed by the people who are qualified. The anti-vaxxers have a point. Not about the safety of vaccines. I believe that they are 100% wrong about vaccines, and that everyone who can should get a full schedule of vaccines for themselves and for their children. But anti-vaxxers have a point about the process. About 20 years ago, Purdue Pharma introduced a new blockbuster painkiller to replace its existing flagship product, MS-Contin, whose patent had expired. The new drug, OxyContin, was said to be safe and long-lasting, with effects that would last an incredible 12 hours, without provoking the fast adaptation response characteristic of other opioids, which drive users to take higher and higher doses. What's more, the company claimed that the addictive potential of opioids was vastly overstated, citing a one-paragraph letter to the New England Journal of Medicine, penned by Boston University Medical Center's Dr. Herschel Jick, who claimed that an internal, unreviewed study showed that opioids could be safely given at higher doses for longer times than had been previously thought. Purdue Pharma weaponized the Jick letter, making it one of the most cited references in medical research history, the five most consequential sentences in the history of the New England Journal of Medicine. Through a cluster of deceptive tactics, only coming to light now through a string of state lawsuits, Purdue created the opioid epidemic, which has killed more than 200,000 Americans and counting, more than died in the Vietnam War. Purdue made $31 billion. The Sackler family, owner of Purdue, are now richer than the Rockefellers. The regulators had every reason to know that something terrible was going on, from the small-town pharmacies ordering millions of pills to the dead piling up in the streets of American cities and towns. The only way they could miss the opioid crisis and its roots in junk science is if they were actively seeking not to learn about it. And no surprise, given how many top regulators come from industry and have worked at an opioid giant, and more, they are often married to pharma execs. They're godparents to other pharma execs' kids. They're the executor of pharma execs' estates. All the normal tight social bonds from the top players in concentrated industries. 10 years ago, if you came home from the doctors with a prescription for Oxy, an advice that they were not to be feared for their addictive potential, and an admonition that pain was the fourth vital sign and its undertreatment was a great societal cruelty, you might have met someone who said that this was all bullshit, that you were being set up to be murdered by a family of ruthless billionaires whose watchdog has switched sides. You might have called that person an opioid denier. Today, we worry that anti-vaxxers represent the resurgence of long-dormant epidemics. Tomorrow, we may find that they presaged an epidemic of collapsed trust in our shared ability to determine the truth. We view fake news as though it was a contagion. Some people have bad ideas, and if you get too close to them, the bad ideas will rub off on you, and you'll get them too. Anti-vax thinking has been around literally since the invention of the first vaccines, but it has been as dormant as measles for decades. Until something changed. Some people say that anti-vax came back because we forgot how terrible measles were. Some say it's big tech and its ability to amplify bad messages. But not everyone is anti-vax. It remains a fringe view, albeit one that has the power to do real harm. What is it that makes some people vulnerable to anti-vax messages? I think it's the trauma of living in a world where there is ample evidence that our truth-seeking exercises can't be trusted. That's a genuinely scary idea, because if the truth is open to the highest bidder, then we are facing a future of chaos and terror where you can't trust the food on your plate, the roof over your head, or the school your child attends. Fake news is an instrument for measuring trauma and the epistemological incoherence that trauma creates, the justifiable mistrust of the establishment that has nearly murdered our planet and that insists that making the richest among us much, much richer will benefit everyone. Eventually. The contagion model for fighting fake news, replacing untrue statements with true ones, is like firefighting. It's necessary, but it is responsive, even reactionary. The trauma model of fake news says that the fires will continue until we clear away the brush that makes them so easy to spark. Until we address the underlying corruption that is rotting our society, fires will continue to rage. Simply put, if you want to make conspiracy theories less plausible, you should start by stamping out conspiracies. We are in the midst of a great debate about the causal relationships of massive changes in our society. Did Trump cause Trumpism, or did Trumpism give rise to Trump? I think it's the latter. Trump isn't smart enough to be the cause of much of anything, but our society has a Trump-shaped hole in it, a place for someone who taps into incoherent anger. Trump is the planchette, and the voters were the ideomotor response. The gerrymanderers and disinformation warriors who got him over the top made a difference at the margins. But they wouldn't have been able to move the planchette if the ideomotor response wasn't pushing it towards the presidency to begin with. All right, then, I'm going to do my best to talk to you again next week. For my American friends, happy 4th of July. For my Canadian friends, happy Canada Day. And for my Indigenous friends, my commiserations, because neither of those really give you much to celebrate. Anyway, talk to you next week.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.